Interview with Collins, Sir Charles, 25th of January, 1966.
I would like to take up brain scheme now. I know something about it. You said you were dubious about it.
Well, but at one time, I was dubious at what he called his land treacheries. I didn't like the title for one thing, I suppose that really gave it. But the idea of holding a, what he called a land treachery didn't appeal to me very much. But the basis of the thing was extraordinary good.
Well, you thought the idea of indivisible leasehold was good?
Excellent, yes. It was a way of dealing with the fragmentation of land, which is so bad in the Kentian provinces, particularly. Under Kentian law, land is left, only gets divided up into small fragments and becomes unworkable in time.
What about the scheme in practice? Wasn't it rather difficult, if not impracticable, from the administrative point of view?
It was a bit difficult, but we got over it, and we used to go out. What we did was we decided that a piece of crown land in a village was wanted, should be divided up for all sorts of purposes. And then we would inspect the land and decide what it should be used for. And certain sections would be set aside for village expansion. Well, the Tisbamba wasn't a Tisbamba. But that was a piece of land, a part of the big crown area, which was set aside for village expansion. And you set aside another little piece that you'd want for a village school, or perhaps a set of bungalow or something of that sort of you'd want, or and then the other land would be for the village's other purposes. Some land would be set aside for sort of a village cultivation, others for forests.
This is mapping out, is it?
It's mapping out, yes. Yes. And then when you've done all that, then you get your villagers around you, go out on circuit and settle down, get your villagers around you and ask them what they wanted, tell them what was available and show them, and it all be explained to them by the chief headman and their own headman. And then you'd allot the land accordingly. And give them deeds. And it really worked very well. It's going on now.
Yes, I see. But from the administrative point of view, didn't it mean an awful lot of work, not only during the cutchery, but an awful lot of supervision later on?
It did. It did mean a lot of supervision. The chief headman was very good at it. They took an interest in it. But we found it necessary, because when I was in Ratnapura, we were doing, GA Ratnapura, we were doing quite a lot of this. We found it necessary to have a special officer attached to us for the purpose. So I had Senator Ratner was there for one. I had another officer attached to his AGA, whose work was almost entirely on this business of mapping out and looking after villagers.
Oh, I see.
Seeing everything's going on all right.
Was it possible for the man to keep an eye on all these plots which he had given out?
Well, he did it through the headman. And you had to trust the headman, and they were pretty good.
But nevertheless, wasn't it possible for villagers to get around the conditions?
Well, I suppose they did to a certain extent, but I think on the whole, taking on the whole, that the scheme was a success.
Again, when you gave out the land, for instance, you went to a village and gave it out, on what principles did you allot the land?
You had a game to depend on the headman very largely, who would ascertain the needs and the, what people there were in the village who hadn't any land, and those who had land. And he would come up with his lists, but he couldn't cheat very well because you had all the villages around you. So he had to be pretty accurate in what he was doing. And otherwise he wouldn't remain in Arachi very long.
Wasn't the idea to give land to only those who were landless?
Well, to those who required land. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily entirely landless, mm-hmm. but it was to make the villager generally a landed person, giving mm-hmm. land. So the.
But what is your definition of landless in any event? Because it would have been quite possible for the son of a moderate to rich landowner to claim that he was landless.
I think that would be seen so. He wouldn't be put down in he wouldn't get his name put down in the Arachis list if he had expectations of land from his parents and was working on that. Then, of course, in certain circumstances, his name would go down.
You see, I bring this point because there is an English social anthropologist who lived in a village in Anuradhapura for 6 months in the 1950s. And he found that of the lots given under this tenure to that village, all of them were to the members of the richer group of families. There were about four households, and the richer group had got it, and the more sort of downtrodden and poorer lot hadn't got it. The richer group being those who comprised, including the headman and his family.
Well, that would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things you have to watch really carefully. It could happen, sir. Mm-hmm. And of course, caste could come into the game, too. Mm-hmm. You're very careful indeed in the village where there was a hamlet of a low caste, that those low caste people didn't come into the main. Mm-hmm. If they could. That's a thing you have to watch all the time. That sort of thing could happen. But it wouldn't happen very frequently because you've got so many people on top of you. You see, you've got the Radhavahatma Obama who's looking into things, he's a generally trustworthy man. And nowadays you've got divisional
DROs
instead of Radhavahatmas. They're watching the thing all the time, and then the headmen are watching too. I don't think it would be some of it. And the GA or the land officer couldn't possibly avoid some of it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Did the villagers themselves understand what was being given to them?
Oh yes. Oh yes, they understood all right.
Oh, they knew it was not the normal type of freehold.
Oh, they knew well. Yes, they knew well.
Uh-huh.
A villager is not such a simple thing as some people think. He's pretty cute man.
And again, another way in which the villagers might have got around conditions was that, say, you gave an acre to one man. He couldn't divide it as far as ownership went.
No.
But he could divide it as far as cultivation went. And
well,
give
you
it to folk.
That, could you? Well, you could stop in a way. I mean, he'd be breaking the...
The conditions.
Conditions. And if he did it blatantly and too bad, particularly if he caught up with a hitman, he'd lose it all.
Oh, I see. Mm. Didn't it bring the man who was, the AGA, who was supervising these plots and seeing to the seeing that the conditions were kept, didn't this bring the AGA into a rather odious form of contact with the villager?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so, because the villager realised that the land officer was doing his best for him,
mm-hmm.
and was trying to keep the regulations. And if in a blatant case, because the villagers probably wouldn't object in ordinary cases, in most cases. I mean, a little bit of that sort of thing would go on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's any blatant cases, I think the villager would mention it,
mm-hmm.
get it brought up somehow or other. Once it came to the ears of the revenue officer, it would be inquired into at least.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Mm.
according to this social anthropologist, the villagers didn't like this form of tenure. And one reason was that it couldn't be used to get credit.
Well, I wonder where you got that from.
Or from this village he was staying in.
What credit do they want?
You see, normally a villager needs borrows money and he uses his land as security. But this wasn't accepted.
But he doesn't do that, really. Religion in Anuradhapura, I thought he kept his land as security for.
Sometimes they do, yes. Sometimes the only villagers do. Of course, I would say that one of the specific purposes behind this scheme was to prevent that sort of thing.
Yes, that's what it was, yes. Yes. Mm. Yes. And generally speaking, the villager got his credit all right from the local Tamil, the local Mormon, without any participation or anything.
Oh, did he?
Mm-hmm. With trust, rather than trust.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether how it's working out now, but the Tamil used to do well out of it, but I don't think he gave much, I don't think he got much security.
Early when I raised the point of whether British rule had lacked drive and imagination, one of the things I was thinking of was this scheme. I was wondering whether it couldn't have been brought into effect earlier.
I a little bit doubtful. You see, it had to follow land settlement.
Mm-hmm.
If you couldn't settle these lands until the land had been you couldn't give out the land until it had been settled. And land settlement itself was going on quite early on.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So I don't think there could have been much more drive. I mean, the main drive during the period, because when I was at GA, look after the interest, the general interest of the people, see that they had proper roads and sanitation and water supplies and all that.
In the 1920s, was it, or earlier?
That was a little later, 1930, when I was in Ratnapura. The whole period I was there, my work was very largely, I was very busy there indeed, and went on circuit a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But we spent a lot of our time there in dealing with these things, water supplies, villages, and government of villages, and building houses according to proper plans, and sanitation, and the provision of latrines, and so on, all that sort of thing.
Ratnapura district have much crown land to give out under the scheme?
In certain calls, yes. Yes, Upper Cullen, for instance, there's quite a lot done in Upper Cullen call, and some in Nedran Cuttawat.
But I should have thought that some areas are pretty well occupied, then.
Oh, some areas are fairly well occupied, yes.
And what happened with regard to mapping out in these cramped and occupied areas?
Oh, you didn't do it where there was no crown land. You couldn't map out. You really map out where you had land for it. But in Ratnapura, there was plenty of land.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kukul Kaw, there wasn't much mapping out done in the Kukul Kaw when I was there, but there was massive crown land there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I say, Atukalan Kaw was one of the... We had a good Ratnamahatma there.
Atukalan?
Mm-hmm. We had a good Ratnamahatma there, and he was interested in it, and that went on quite a lot. And Ratwati in the... There's Ratwati, Advanced Ratwati Edgar, the mother of Cinema.
Oh, yes, of course.
Mother, oh, you're a grand man.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a lot of mapping out in his division, and he looked after things well. He's a very good man.
To jump to another sphere, but allied to present interest, this cooperative credit movement.
Yes.
Was it Sir Frank Stockdale who originated the idea? Or Campbell?
It was Campbell, really.
Mm-hmm.
More Campbell than anybody else. Stockdale, I think, was interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
But Campbell was put on to do it and did it.
Mm-hmm.
And Mabin helped him.
Yes. What sort of men were Stockdale, Campbell and Mabin?
Oh, they were very very good men. Stockdale, of course, was agricultural.
Oh, I see.
Director of Agriculture. He wasn't in the civil service.
Mm-hmm.
Director of Agriculture. I didn't know he had so much to do. It was more Cameron. Yes. Campbell was took a tremendous interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he followed the Scandinavian pattern, rather.
Mm-hmm. What sort of success did it have?
Oh, no, it had no success. There were, I've got some here somewhere. In this book, there's something about it. Cooperative credits. I think it's in here. You found the best accounts of it in the Ceylon annual reports.
Yes, I see, yes. When you say success,
I thought I had a lot of balance here with Temple. Oh no, at another place I've got it, not in here.
When you say success, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean there are a great many societies, mm-hmm. cooperative credit societies, in the country altogether, and considerable strides were made also in the field of rural cooperatives. The movement had its origin as early as 1913. And the first societies were mainly in the country districts, generally among peasants. The enthusiasm for another civil servant, W.H.K. Campbell, was responsible for much of the development, modelled after Scandinavian practice. Later, many consumer societies were founded in urban as well as in rural areas, and as in England, a cooperative wholesale society was started to supply the needs of the retail societies. In 1945, a Department of Cooperative Development was formed to plan and guide the movement. In the following year, that's in 1946, there were 6,500 societies, of which over 4,000 were consumer societies, with a membership of over a million and sales amounted to 165 million rupees.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Would you say that the war also gave it a boost?
I don't think it affected it very much. It was going on quite nicely in any case.
What was the response of the people?
Well, they seemed to like it.
Mm-hmm.
Campbell, I think, always found that people were interested in it and formed societies without any great urging.
Wasn't there some sort of difference in approach between Campbell and Serenaica? Serenaica wanted to hasten it on and to use it for more utilitarian purposes, while Campbell wanted a more gradual development.
I have heard that. It might be so.
Mm-hmm. No, I was wondering why...
Senator Michael was always in a hurry, of course, to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And Campbell would be more cautious. He was a Scot.
I was wondering why he left.
Campbell... I don't know. He was one of the many who did leave, but he wasn't disillusioned or anything. He actually took part in. He helped the colonial office in cooperative
later
after he left.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't leave because the thing was failing. Really, mm-hmm.
No, I was wondering whether he felt he couldn't get on under
the knife. I never heard so. Mm-hmm. Serenaica wasn't a difficult man to work with, you know, to get to...
Oh, I thought he, drove Wilson and Kennedy away.
Well,
And Cameron.
Perhaps to a certain extent they may have clashed. I think they did clash a bit. But I never found Serenaica difficult. You had to listen to him and had to yield to him very often. I mean, he generally got his way.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were going to stand out against him, you'd lose. But I don't think I've never heard that Campbell and Serenaica got up against each other.
No, I was just I'm not certain, but it's just an idea.
No, I don't think that was it. Campbell, I think Campbell probably, like a good many other people, great many people in the civil service. And the time came, thought it an opportunity to retire. He wasn't married, he hadn't.
Oh, I see.
He could get on quite well without the civil service. Settled down. And also, he's very, very interested in this business of cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And he rather helped in the colonial office.
Mm-hmm.
In various other parts of the world.
Was the enthusiasm and the incentive he had brought kept on afterwards?
Well, of course, I think it lost a little of its impetus when he left it, but it's still going.
Mm-hmm. What about corruption?
What, in that department? Oh, I don't think it's worse than anywhere else. I think you find that right up to the end of the... I can tell you that. Just a minute. That's after 1938. From 1938, there were 1,299 societies in 1938. There were 6,631 in 1946. And the working capital was 4 million rupees in 1938. And the working capital was 36 million odd in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And the types of societies, there's a list of them given.
Yes, yes, I see.
Most of them were consumer societies, 4,000 odd. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was at the end of the British period, it was still going very fast.
Yes.
That was the end of the Donwell period,
mm-hmm.
and Senator Michael was largely in charge of it.
Another sort of department I'm interested in is the rural marketing, which is one aspect of it, I presume.
Rural marketing was...
Bassett's job.
Bassett's, yes, that was different though.
Mm-hmm.
Marketing department, Marketing Department, page 69 on this book. Because I haven't myself personally much to do with this. Marketing department. No, we've got a right. Yes, it was still going on.
Yes, I see. But is that I must check up on the books on that book and. Annual reports.
Those are the things to work on. They're very good.
Mm-hmm.
They've been very well done. They're done by the Department of Statistics and very well done.
There's one thing on the Land Settlement Department which I forgot to raise. The question of chain of reserve and Mr. Freeman's criticism.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, Freeman, of course, was very much liked in the North Central Province. And there's a case of a government agent standing up for his villages against the central government.
Mm-hmm.
And the central government's view of that chain was it was a wasteful form of cultivation, and
mm-hmm.
it far better give way to a system by which people let their land stand fallow for a year or two, and then you did just like, not chain them in, but a rotation of crops.
Mm-hmm.
That was the central government's idea, and he was all against it. He said the villages always have chain, and provision must be made for the chain. And
mm-hmm.
so there was a lot of trouble between him and the central government, but he stuck to his guns. And
I see. But chain in involves a certain rotation of land, doesn't it?
Well, what it does is, so you, first of all, you destroy the forest. Mm-hmm. The forest, it's gone completely. Yeah. And it never grow again.
Yes, but the forest that they destroyed was not a genuine forest, but a scrubland.
No, it was originally a genuine forest, originally.
That was in the way back long
ago.
Well,
yes, but for 100 years maybe, or something of that sort.
Yes, so you could reclaim that from your position in whatever you did.
You could, in some parts of the country, yes. Because the high trees were felled. I've seen chain areas where forest trees have been felled, trees which were quite fit for cutting for forestry purposes. They're taken down. Probably those trees may have been up there for 200 years. They've gone, cut, burnt, finished.
Yes, but those trees are of no value unless they are in a plantation and unless they can be transported to a place of...
Well, there will be a value in time. See, there will be a value. If they were left alone, there would be a value. But then, you see, what happens is then they're taken down and finished with, that's gone. Then the land becomes scrub. And there's no use for anything at all, unless it's properly cultivated, which isn't properly cultivated. The scrub land is grown for a poor crop of millet or curriculum or something as well. Mm-hmm. And then it's left
fallow for 10, 15 years.
Yes, 20. Yes. It's the most wasteful use of land.
That may be so, but if I may put the case, take the position, say, in 1920, most of the land in the NCP, and again in Hambantota, in Wolves district, most of it was not forest, but already scrub.
There was a degree of forest, very considerable degree of forest, but some of it was scrub, yes.
So why couldn't you let them chain on the scrub?
Well, as a matter of fact, that's what did happen.
Mm-hmm.
But what the central government wanted them to do was to take up areas and cultivate those areas properly,
mm-hmm.
and rotation of crops.
But
of course, the difficulty was, of course, that there wasn't sufficient water for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. So
it was a vicious circle, really.
Yes.
And to a certain extent, one had sympathy with Freeman.
Mm-hmm. I thought he was rather unpopular at the centre.
He was very unpopular at the centre.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very obstinate. A dear old man, I was very fond of him, but he did give us a lot of trouble in the secretariat.
Mm-hmm.
His blessed chaining. But of course, people loved him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did. Well, they elected him.
Yes. Both to the Legislative Council and to the State Council.
Well, that's what I would like to come to next, really, the State Legislative Council and the constitutions of the 1920s, which you had a hand in them.
I had a hand in those, yes, because perhaps more than other people that you've met in a way, because
certainly
I was right in the midst of it all.
There was one in 1920, and that is under Manning.
Yes.
And another in 1924.
Yes.
Did you have a hand in both?
Only, of course, I didn't actually help in drawing them up.
Oh.
But I did a lot of the donkey work connected with them. Helping to get the dispatches going and all that sort of thing.
Oh, I see.
And then I was in council at the time. Mm-hmm. I was clerk to the council.
Oh, I see. That's very interesting.
The Legislative Council.
Was it Governor Manning who had the...
Manning was...
Who originated the specific suggestions, or was it someone else in the Secretariat?
No, it was Manning. Well, it was Manning, but of course it was in the Executive Council, of course,
mm-hmm.
that was controlled out. I mean, he wasn't only Manning. And,
who were the other men? Alexander?
I've forgotten who was in the Executive Council at the time.
Southall?
Well, they all had a little bit of help. But Manning was mainly the governor and his legal advisor. 1920, I suppose that was it Manning in 1920?
Yes. Just come, I think.
Yes.
Graham Thompson would have been there for a while.
He helped, of course, in it.
Mm.
Mm. Well, Anderson, of course,
Adam appointed a commission. And then you had the National Congress formulated demands.
Yes. And it was on that basis that the Constitution was drawn up.
Yes, that's so, yes. There were long negotiations between Ceylon and London after that. And then the 13th of August 1920, the reconstituted Legislative Council, 14 official and 23 unofficial members appointed. But the Council ruled at once that wasn't good enough for them, they wanted more.
In effect, it would seem that that constitution was not good or very insufficient.
It didn't go far enough, no.
Did you
It didn't give them what they did it two things, apparently. One was it wasn't as far as they wanted to go, and another was that it didn't give them the share in the government that they hoped to have. They wanted a little more say in the matter. And then they passed a series of motions for further reform. And then, as you said, the discussions in council brought to the fore a marked difference of opinion between the Sinhalese on the one hand and the Tamil minorities on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1924 constitution was intended to meet this other.
Would it be correct to say that in the 1924 constitution, at least the constitution as drawn up by Manning, there was an attempt to have a sort of careful balance of interest.
Yes, there was. Yes.
So that you would never get a united opposition.
That was what it came to. See if I've got it here. This is what it came to. I thought I'd put it down. The result of it was a representative government with communal interests well looked after. That's what it comes to, that they so arranged that the majority members couldn't impose their will on the others. A sort of balance.
But the Secretary of State's amendment altered that, did it?
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, I've not got it here, probably. That was so, though. Wait a minute. I've got it here, yes, that's right. The Manning's proposals. Manning made his own proposals, which provide a balance between the communities to prevent the preponderance of power in any one community. And his proposals were in fact based on communal representation. And with this, the Secretary of State agreed, saying that in his opinion, having regard to the conditions prevailing in Ceylon, representation for an indefinite period of time must in fact be communal.
Mm-hmm.
And if all elected members were returned by territorial the constituencies, they would nonetheless be in substance communal.
Mm.
The Secretary of State agreed in general with the Governor, but introduced modifications in the scheme which tended to upset the balance.
Mm-hmm.
That was right, yes. Mm. I haven't got to share exactly what they were, but that is the position.
What sort of man was Manning as a Governor?
Oh, yes, he was a soldier, of course.
Mm.
And just a little bit inclined to be like a soldier, a little bit
authoritative,
a little bit, but very, very nice, very pleasant to work with. And the Ceylonese got on very well with him.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of members of council, they all respected him.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't quite like, say, Anderson, who was very, very popular with them.
Yes, but that was because Anderson was popular because of his view on the rights.
Partly that, and partly his own personality.
Oh, I see.
But Manning's personality was a little different from that. But he was respected and liked by the people.
How did Sir Graham Thompson?
Oh, he was better still. He was liked more, I think. He's very nice.
He was a, what do you call him, an imaginative and far-seeing thought?
I should think so, yes. Mm-hmm. I think we could say that now. Thompson more than many. Mm. Yes.
Would it be correct to say that after this constitution, the center of gravity shifted from the executive council to the finance committee of this new constitution?
I should think the finance committee had a very great deal to do.
Because
mm-hmm. the finance committee had been in existence since 1910.
Mm-hmm.
But it was here just about this time that it felt its, made its power felt.
Mm-hmm.
It was a difficult one to work, but I owned a lot.
Oh yes, what were your impressions of the council in this 20 to 24 period as clerk?
The council was, you see, the council suffered from the thought that it could criticise, but it had no real authority. It couldn't order anything to be done.
Mm-hmm.
That was the power, that was the executive council could order things to be done, the executive authority, but not the legislative authority.
Mm-hmm.
So they could criticise, and they did criticise. And then they took it up still more in the finance committee.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that wasn't in public, it was a private meeting consisting of all the unofficial members plus the chief secretary, the controller of revenue and the treasurer. And they got the heads of departments up and they had an awful time. It was very, very difficult indeed.
Were they very unreasonable? Yes,
always criticising and trying to find fault with the departments. Sometimes they liked the head of the department and he got off all right, but very often the meetings were quite unpleasant. And I must say that some of the European members were bad as anybody else.
Looking at the 1924 constitution as it is on paper, I would have thought that it was based on rather bad principles. Because it had an unofficial majority who had
yes.
financial power,
yes.
but no responsibility, as you say. And this was the sort of thing which had not worked in America two centuries before, and even in the West Indies in the 19th century.
It wasn't intended to be a final constitution.
No, but...
Something warming up to it. So they didn't think they could have ministers at that stage. So this was leading up to it, but it didn't work properly.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I wouldn't say bad exactly, but it didn't work as it should have done.
You see, Sir Hugh Clifford called it an unworkable constitution, but Herbert Stanley later said that cooperation had outweighed outweighed criticism, and that it was a qualified success.
It was a qualified success, that's right.
You think so?
Yes, it was, oh, definitely. There was no doubt about that.
What exactly do you mean by qualified
success? Well, I mean, it was a success in the sense that if you satirise to the council itself and see how things were going on, everything went on all right. We've got your budget through, found the money you wanted, the executive acts were all performed, country was carried on, everything went on all right. The only thing which was wrong about it was that the council itself wasn't working happily altogether. There was this trouble, especially in the finance committee.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from that, everything was going on all right.
Yes, but couldn't it be argued that everything went on all right simply because it had to? I mean, there was no... Obviously, it would come if it didn't go on all right, the government would be at a standstill. So whatever the constitution, these things had to go on, and they did go on.
Well, there's something in that, yes. Yes. But it was a little more... It was a little better than that because there was a lot of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Despite these
outbursts from time to time in the finance committee and in the state council, there was actually a lot of cooperation. And a bill was introduced and you have a standing committee on it, and the standing committee was excellent. It did its work splendidly. And bills were passed and all that. So that it was... unworkable in the sense that it was never, in the council itself, it was never very happy.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the results were concerned, it was successful. You got the results all right, and you got a certain amount of harmony. Funny to get a sort of position.
Mm-hmm. Were GAs also brought before council and held up?
I don't remember any case of GA being brought in. The heads of departments, yes. Well, the GA was a head of the department, but I don't remember any case of GA being brought in.
Would it be correct to say that heads of departments at that time were not very politically minded and therefore took this kind of thing very badly?
That's true, yes. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. Yes.
Can you remember who were the leading vilifiers or leading critics?
Well, as a matter of fact, some of the European members were as difficult as any.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the various Sudanese members too. Mm-hmm. I couldn't pick out any particular ones. But
it was a general tendency.
General tendency of a really fine chance of having taken a shy at somebody or other.
Wasn't this partly because of a sense of frustration? I mean, while they had some power, they were still not in on the government.
Yes, that's just true. Mm-hmm. That there was that feeling there. And that was one of the troubles of the whole constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had an unofficial majority, but with that unofficial majority, they couldn't
execute.
No, they couldn't execute. They couldn't put up a lamppost in the street until so they could put the money for it.
Yes. The Donimo Commission said that the civil servants were demoralised as a result.
Well, of course, that was true in the sense that if you vilify the head of the department and he becomes disgruntled, say the head of the police, for instance,
mm-hmm.
well, it goes down all through his department.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say they were demoralised, that's going a bit far. But the effect of that sort of vilification, the feeling that the main body of councillors, elected councillors, were acting against you. You were doing your utmost in the country, and these people were up against you, finding fault with everything you did. It gave a bad feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So the services weren't working as well as they would have done otherwise. Mm-hmm. You can't work for people who don't show any gratitude for what you do.
Mm-hmm. Apart from these attacks in council, was there much criticism in the press or even at public meetings as well?
Not much, no. No, not as far as I remember. Well, of course, the press, to a certain extent in the press, that always happened. It happens here now.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't bad. And we got on pretty well overall.
If I may say so, civil servants seem to, that the civil servants in the field seem to be less annoyed with the politicians than with the secretariat, or rather with the colonial secretary, for not defending them, not protecting them.
Well, some of them did put up that sort of idea, but because the colonial secretary did his best for them, couldn't do more than he did.
Would it be correct to say that among this colonial secretary and Treasurer and others were finding themselves in a rather difficult position, found that they had to give in to some of the politicians' demands in order to get their way on others?
A certain amount of give and take, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they'd give in to anything they thought was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But a certain amount of give and take. I mean, these things are extremely amusing, really. You'd fight like cats and dogs in the council. You'd come out and a tea would be waiting for you on a number of tables, and you'd all sit down and have tea together and as jolly and friendly as you could possibly be. And then over the tea table you'd settle anything.
Is it correct to say that these politicians had two faces, the public face and the private face? To put it in a rather exaggerated form, perhaps.
Well, all politicians have, really, haven't they? Mm-hmm. In a way. I mean, Wilson and Heath fight each other like cats and dogs in the cat in the government. They go out arm in arm almost afterwards. So with these people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we used to have it when I was in the state council afterwards.
tussle themselves and come out as friendly as possible. Mm-hmm. And if you call that being two-faced, it was two-faced. But it wasn't, there's no real animosity, that's mm-hmm. what it comes to. even in the finance committee, I think that a lot of it was done with their tongue and their cheeks, you know, and it wasn't really so bitter as it seemed.
Just another aspect in the 20s, regarding the secretariat, was it a bottleneck?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I said, no doubt it was, because you see, in the 20s, when I was there, for instance, all that time I was there, stuff came up from all departments right into it, right like that, you see.